My guest today has worked inside the justice system at every level, from taking down organized crime to overseeing thousands of cases as criminal chief of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of California. Hallie Hoffman has been a career federal prosecutor, a leader inside the Department of Justice, and most recently served as general counsel of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. Along the way, she stepped out of government to build a biotech company from scratch, one she founded out of a lab, scaled in Silicon Valley, and ultimately sold to Roche. She's one of the rare people who has operated in law, government, and tech at the highest levels, and she brings a perspective few others have. Before we get started, I want to remind you this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. Hey, Hallie Hoffman, welcome to Onward.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into my questions, can you just give a little outline of your background? Because it's really a fun mix of two different worlds.
I have been a career prosecutor. I started after law school, clerked on the Ninth Circuit, came straight to the DOJ, where I was a federal prosecutor for about 7.5 years, and then left the DOJ to start a biotech company and moved out to the Bay Area, started the company once it got up and running and was in a good position, went back to doing my first love and went back to the U.S. Attorney's Office and was a federal prosecutor, ultimately became criminal chief of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District, then came out to the D.C. area to be the general counsel at DEA, where I was general counsel for over 3 years.
You make it sound so easy. So you were general counsel of the Drug Enforcement Administration. You were chief of division in the Northern District, so you saw all sorts of stuff. I was doing some research, and I think there were something like 1,000 cases with your name on it. Too many for me to get through. And then you built and sold a tech company, which you were very understated about, which we'll come to in a minute. Tech and law and government, which, by the way, sounds very apropos these days.
I love that. Oh, I was very lucky, Ben. The tech company was the unique circumstance where my brother came to me. He had developed a technology and asked if I would run with it and build a company out of it. Of course, no big task. And I was like, are you kidding me? I prosecute organized crime. That's the thing about brothers. They believe you can do anything.
And you did it.
Yeah.
He was right. Do you want to tell your founding story and then I can ask follow-up questions?
Absolutely. The technology was a non-invasive prenatal diagnostic test. My sister-in-law was put in a very high risk category, was having a child later in life, and was like, this test is just not reliable. It was a protein-based test. And she remembered, she's a geneticist, and remembered that you can separate fetal DNA from maternal DNA. The problem was no one had quite figured out how to do it because they were trying to do a whole cell separation. And she was like, well, what if I focused on the fragments? So she spent her pregnancy figuring out how to do it, came up with this technology with my brother. And then they came to me in New York and asked me to start a company. I had done a lot of really incredible cases, had been fortunate enough to try cases in all different areas of the law. And I thought, I should try to do this. I really want to get this out there to the world. I was lucky enough to dive in, spent about 1.5 months in their lab, making sure I understood what was going on with the actual biology of it all. And then got the licenses away from universities and got some funding for the company and was able to get it to market, which was fantastic. And then we ultimately sold it to Roche.
So you raise your Series A from Venrock. How did that happen?
As it works out, it turns out a lot of people were like, oh, what does Hallie know about starting a company? Not a lot of people, but one of my dear friends. So she was like, I'm going to introduce her to this entrepreneur. It's actually how I met my husband. He knew someone, a venture capitalist in the biotech space. And when I met with her and discussed the technology, she actually connected me to someone at Venrock. She's like, they're looking for something exactly in this space. So it was fantastic. It just was right place, right time.
And that's Ken Song?
Ken Song was the ultimate person who I was introduced to. The intermediary, I'm blanking on her name right now, but very grateful for the handoff in between.
You leapt from law to startup. And not only did you have a successful startup and satisfy your brother, but you met your husband.
That's right. When I moved out from New York to San Francisco, It's funny. I said to my brother, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to start it in the Bay Area. I'd love to tell you, Ben, that was because I was smart enough to know that there was venture money in the Bay Area that I might eventually need. That wasn't it at all. It was my best friend from law school was living in San Francisco. And I thought, if I'm going to live on a couch and eat peanut butter and jelly and try and start this company, it was going to be with her and I was going to enjoy it. So it was really a win-win for me.
I always think of lawyers as being very risk averse. How does this make sense to you psychologically?
I'm a very mission-driven person, and I would say that is what counteracts in some ways that risk averse. Women past a certain age, if you prioritize your career before having kids, you're immediately put in certain risk categories. Being put in a certain risk category does require you to have additional testing. The fact that there was a protein-based test instead of a blood test for these chromosomal abnormalities made it less reliable and actually more risky for the pregnancy. So it seemed like something that I really believed in that I wanted to get out there. And I thought, if I don't try it now, this isn't going to happen. This is what we have to do to get things out there.
I feel like the punchline is you sold it for $625 million in like 36 months or something.
It was a very short amount of time. I was very fortunate because then I got to go back to being a prosecutor. And that's something that I really do feel strongly about. A lot of times you see that government careers are really hard. I made many degrees more in that 36 months than I made in my 22 years as a public servant in the Department of Justice.
I like the way you frame that because it is public service. It doesn't really get the credit that is public service at this point. It feels like going to work for the government has a low brand status at the moment. Why do you think that is? And how do you think you change people's mind about that?
I do think the disconnect between public trust and some of these law enforcement careers is one of the biggest concerns that law enforcement faces. There have been some things in law enforcement that have broken that trust. But generally speaking, it is so necessary to have and to encourage people to go into these careers. It is so necessary because there are limited resources, and in order to maximize the impact, you need to be able to communicate what you are doing. I think we're starting to turn a corner a little bit about that. It used to be the fact that people would shy away from working with the government because working with the government had a negative connotation. What I've seen in the past year, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm optimistic, is that more and more people are prioritizing public safety, are prioritizing that public-private partnership, and it's not just viewed as an evil thing to work with the government. And we need that. We need that in order to maximize what can be done in law enforcement.
Maybe this podcast helps shed some light. Before we were on the podcast, you were saying that a lot of your peers who do public service don't usually talk to the press or any public forum. And even you had some reluctance.
The instinct is it's a little self-promoting. There is a quicksand. You could step in something where you're talking about something in a particular case or for a particular client, and you don't want to do that. To extrapolate a little bit further, in the prosecution world, I think it can break down to two types of cases. You have the cases where you're going to have a high volume of cases. These are more like the hand-to-hand deals or the gun cases or something like that. And then you have the very high impact cases. The huge fraud cases or something that are going to take years and years to prosecute. Broadly speaking, that's a huge generalization. But even the most discrete high volume cases take a lot of time because the system is so individualized. It needs to be based on the way justice works. You have individualized facts, you have the individual defendant, you have individualized victims, and it is necessary to rely on all of that individualization that slows down the system. There really does need to be the ability to announce what's happening, to make public what you're doing in order to have a deterrent effect. I'm not saying every criminal sits there and thinks, what are the consequences? But there needs to be a publication of, we're looking at this sort of crime. The crime that's easiest to think about that is something like bankruptcy fraud. The entire system is based on trust that you're going to perform these honest filings. There's no way that we have the amount of resources to look at every bankruptcy filing. So that means when you actually catch a bankruptcy fraud, you need to be very public about the prosecution of it because that will deter others. There's a consequence if you lie on these forms. We'd all love to say that no one's going to lie on the forms anyway, but sometimes there needs to be a check.
Is this personal or corporate bankruptcy?
I would say either. For instance, in the tax context, another great one. We don't look at that many tax lines. I'm not encouraging your listeners to commit tax fraud, but there are prosecutions of tax fraud, and maybe people want to do the right thing and pay their taxes and pay for the services of living in the country, or maybe they're concerned about actually being prosecuted for tax violations. If the latter has anything to do with it, they need to know that there actually are tax fraud cases going on. And when there's such a delay between charging and actual conviction, it becomes a sort of, so what? It's so much of a delay. So this crime happened 5 years ago and you're getting a conviction now. In the past, there had been a hesitancy to talk about case charges for the very reason that everyone appreciates. It's just an allegation. It's not proven. There's a hesitancy to discuss what the nature of the charges are. There has been a change in that realm for the last 5 years, maybe, where you see it more and more. And talking about it as they are just charges, but then there is this concept that people are looking at this. They're looking at the fact that whether or not a crime is being committed. And then you're going to get a deterrent effect, even though you're not prosecuting the high volume of crimes, theoretically.
So there seems to be this big disconnect between what people think happens in criminal justice or the justice system broadly, and then what actually happens. What do people most misunderstand about the justice system today in America?
Part of it is what I was already talking about. Truly great cases and operations and different programs really rely on the fundamental drive and grit of an individual agent, an individual attorney. And I'm not saying they do it on their own. They build the team and they amass it all together. It's like when you bet on a founder. You have these drivers of these cases. I'm not so sure if that's really understood. And the interesting thing about it is because it's part of a big system, the key is often when you're leading in those areas, you got to make room for those drivers to really push forward on those cases. That's how you're really going to get to the next level of making the big cases or making a big difference in the justice system.
You're not just talking about you as someone who's led these cases, but also you as a manager who's led a system. You had a team of people, different founders, essentially, or entrepreneurs who were pursuing different lines. So you sort of have both stories to tell. So I'm interested in examples. So when I think of the government, don't think of as massive monolithic organization, but there's these individuals who are trying to make things happen. How does that actually work?
Early on in my career, I had the chance to work on a prosecution of a former prime minister of Ukraine.
An administrator of Ukraine? What is that?
No, prime minister.
Oh, prime minister of Ukraine?
Yeah, of Ukraine. And he had been treating his country like his personal piggy bank and developing programs and siphoning some money off to the side. You might ask why he's prosecuted in the United States. Well, he was laundering the money through banks in San Francisco, living in Eddie Murphy's old mansion. And under money laundering statutes, there are something called SUAs, the substantive underlying activity, and his was this fraud activity. So it was a very lengthy case, required depositions to be taken overseas, which is unusual to take criminal depositions. It's more normal in a civil case. We had to get coordination of 48 countries to be able to take these depositions.
What year is this?
This was back in 2003. A while ago. This was right at the beginning of my career. I think of that and think of this FBI agent that was so determined. He challenged every norm. He did not sleep. He put his public safety at risk just because there was this criminal conduct that he was just not going to give up on. That's just one example. We literally had to prove some violations of Ukrainian law in a U.S. courtroom. I mean, it was crazy. It was like nothing that had ever been done before. But the dedication of those public servants who just went for it and wanted to hold this person accountable. And obviously, that's just one example. I mean, I could go on and on.
That is so wild, though. What happened?
We got a conviction, went to jail for 10 years.
In the United States?
In the United States.
Did you have to do an extradition?
We did not, because the agent got him coming off a plane during the investigation. At one point, came to the United States. It's something I've thought about a lot, whether or not it's an oxymoron to say a humble criminal, because the criminals that I come encounter with have a lot of hubris, or at least the ones we catch. But there's this concept that you know what's best. That usually is the way law enforcement gets criminals.
This is so interesting. There's like a psychological profile that you typically have seen in criminals where they are arrogant or overconfident.
Fundamentally, yes. I don't know if I'm qualified to make these designations, but I do generally think that the typical fraudster convinces themselves that they are doing what's best for everyone so that they know what is right. And there's a certain hubris in that. And then they'll spend the money freely or think they're not going to get caught. And that's usually then what brings it to light.
So that's how you find them. And then does it often lead to the kind of errors in their defense because they lie?
Obstruct justice. Yes. Low-hanging fruit is oftentimes it shows a state of mind when we can charge an obstruction of justice. If you can add that count, you're going to be able to show what the criminal state of mind is and really get to that in front of the jury, which is a huge benefit of adding charges.
Yeah, I saw that and I actually didn't even exactly know what it meant, but often in these big cases you prosecuted, you also got them for obstruction of justice. That sounds bad, but it may not mean exactly what I thought it meant. What does it look like when you're getting someone for obstruction of justice? That lying?
It usually is, would be lying to a law enforcement agent who is taking a statement. If you could show a direct lie, it's totally case dependent. And I'm thinking through my cases. Most of them did involve lies to law enforcement agents in statements that were being made.
Isn't that what got Martha Stewart imprisoned?
Exactly. You could see scenarios where people try to tamper with witnesses. That can be a different charge that could bleed into obstruction of justice.
You're saying what's happening behind the scenes is that there's this less monolithic, more singular or entrepreneurial group of people who are making these things happen. One of my friends was a U.S. Attorney General in New York, or Assistant U.S. Attorney General. He says he got so jaundiced because he just sees so much bad behavior. I don't know if that's what you've experienced as well.
You see a ton of bad behavior. You said U.S. Attorney's Office. I don't know if there's a difference between federal and state. I believe there probably is because I've always worked more in the federal level. If the feds don't take a case, the state may take it. But if the state doesn't take a case, it doesn't get done. And I think there is such a higher volume on the state side. I don't know if this is a fair analogy. This might go totally in left field about what you were saying about being disconcerted. But when I was at DEA, people sometimes ask me, oh, well, how do you not get overwhelmed? We're just going to lose this war on drugs. We would say at DEA, this is a war to save lives. In 2023, which I believe was the highest amount of fentanyl recovery, it's 386 million lethal doses were recovered by the Drug Enforcement Administration. That is an unbelievable amount. And if you focus on the lives saved, it's a different way of seeing it. It's the yin, the yang. It really does drive you forward in terms of mission.
Trying to put that in perspective, because I don't know anything about any of the things you're talking about. Is that dozens of cases, hundreds of cases? Is that a few that really move the needle?
That's hundreds of cases. That type of seizure, thousands potentially across the country. There also are administrative forfeitures that the DEA will do where they will forfeit a huge volume of drugs in a criminal case. You seize them, you charge it criminally, but it also allows you to take instrumentalities of the crime. Sometimes that is to try and have a lasting impact on the system.
What's an instrumentality of the crime?
The vehicles that are used to transport the drug. This is just an example. I'm not talking about any specific case. If you think of it as an operation, you're not just seizing the drugs. You're also seizing the vehicles, the money that they may or may not have. Getting back to this point of maximum impact with one case, you need to use all the tools. And it might have many different tentacles that go out in different ways. So it may not just be the criminal case itself. It may be associated with an administrative forfeiture or a civil forfeiture that's going to accompany the criminal case.
So I have some libertarian friends. I used to have this debate before we legalized marijuana in so many states. So, okay, what do you think the world looks like without drug enforcement? What does it look like without the deterrence, without the forfeitures? Because I feel like for you to appreciate what the consequences are, you have to see what it would look like. Imagine a counterfactual where there's a lot less police, a lot less criminal justice. I know this is a little speculative. It helps, I think, get at this question of what's actually the loss of trust costing you? You said 300 million lethal doses or something. Is that 1% of all the drugs in America? Do you have any sense of how much is being stopped?
The counterfactual is if you're not stopping it, that's going into our communities. That is a huge destructive impact. I'm trying to imagine, and I'm thinking back to a terrible story about fentanyl when I was criminal chief in the Northern District of California. By the way, the Northern District is like 15 counties. So it's Monterey up to the Oregon border. There is a wide variety of crime in those counties. A lot of violent crime, obviously. You have also all the San Jose tech crime, but you also have a lot of organized crime. You have Salinas, which is terrible murder issues, et cetera. This particular case was a father who had overdosed on fentanyl when he was taking care of his child, and the child crawled on top of him to check on his father, breathed in. The dad was still actually breathing. And when the father woke up, the infant was dead next to him. At that moment, this was like nothing we had ever seen before. So it is hard for me when we're talking about legalization. I can't think of a world where that poison is so rampant. What I go to is, okay, well then it's a weapon and the people who have it would have power. You would have cartels keeping the power over U.S. citizens, which I think would be a terrible place to be.
I feel like over the decade, whether it's legalizing or this awesome defund the police arguments, I think there's sometimes this argument that the cure is worse than the disease. You've seen the inside of it. Can you help blow that argument up?
I think we saw to a degree what happens when it goes unregulated. We saw that with the opioid crisis, and we saw how that tore apart communities and disproportionately impacted some of the poorer communities in certain parts of this country. And it was disastrous. There will be impact felt for generations from that. In terms of defund the police, this fundamentally gets back to the trust that we were talking about earlier. When I was in San Francisco during a time, now I think it's changing a little bit, but I can't tell you how many people would come up to me on the side and thank me for what we were doing. There was a toleration of the crime as long as it didn't reach certain populations. I think that's not something that's discussed if people are actually victims of the crime. I think there needs to be a focus on the protection of citizens and victims, which is what public safety is supposed to be. I think that is only possible in a world where there are no bad actors. Maybe such a world exists. We do not live in that world right now, from what I've seen. And until we do, the worst thing to do is to take away funding, because you need funding to have appropriate education. I believe at DEA, the shooting incidents were 0.01% of operations. Incredibly low. There's a lot of reasons for that. DEA has planned enforcement actions. Unlike state police, it's not as reactive. Usually there are these planned operations. We also have a extremely thorough use of force program where lawyers from the general counsel's team, the chief counsel's team, go out with agents and do training in the field on use of force, which I think is an incredible program. Things like that cost money to do. And if you take away and defund, you're not going to be able to have programs like that.
You can't help but notice what's happening with this and so many other things is that social media, what gets viral are these anecdotal narratives that aren't necessarily representative of what's actually happening around anything. But those are what become the public narrative or what become truth. One of the downsides of social media has been this change in how the public views anything because of the way that media is decentralized. The pros and cons to decentralization, it's a hard thing to combat in any sector. I can imagine.
Maybe there's a good there. Maybe if you can flip that in, there's more light to be shed on all the work that's going on. In the past, I think there has been just such a focus on these problematic situations get a lot of airtime. there hasn't been as much emphasis on the great work that is going on in law enforcement, which is needed in order to build that public trust. I don't know how you make that as interesting, because maybe it's just not as interesting to people. I don't know.
Especially if lawyers are afraid to talk to the public.
Exactly. Here we are back at the start.
Burdened by facts. You've been in these large organizations. I don't know how big DEA is or DOJ, but they're massive. What breaks down as you scale justice?
DEA, by the way, is about 10,000.
It's not as big as I thought.
But DEA is part of DOJ. DOJ is obviously much larger. Going back to this small number of cases and the driver of these cases, and I wouldn't say it breaks down. I would say that it needs to be acknowledged and accommodated for. And I think the way to do that is this public awareness that we've been talking about. I think what is another accommodation that in both of these organizations would be extremely helpful is with internal management and leadership. It's very hard to incentivize and hold people accountable in these systems. I think these systems generally think that if you have expertise, you're automatically going to be a good manager or a good leader. And obviously, we know that's the whole skill set that needs to be taught, but there's not a focus on developing managers. And think about trying to motivate a team where you can't incentivize by money. The way you can incentivize is by mission. And that's a lot, where they see colleagues who are not putting in the drive, not putting in the time, and there's really no consequences. Now, I think these things are changing, but it is very hard to grow a team in these systems.
I live in Washington, D.C., so I've seen government for most of my life. And the fact that you can't manage and hire and fire in a government organization is one of the primary reasons why it doesn't operate at a level of excellence that it could. Is that the same type of thing you're saying, or something different?
That's what I'm talking about. And I tried as much as I could to think of ways, even in small ways, there are certain mechanisms in the justice system to give certain benefits, but it is difficult. When I think of different supervisors, people raising their hand to be supervisors, it is so mission-driven. It's incredible what these people do, because they'll put their neck out there to take on these roles where they don't have the tools to actually incentivize or fire or do something with their team. And yet they're also held accountable by the members of the team. It's pretty remarkable to me, actually, how much mission drives these supervisors, but giving them tools would make a huge difference.
When I talk to politicians, I complain to politicians about this. They say it's not like a legislative act. It's actually the public unions that control a lot of this. It's not like there's legislation that put this in place. I don't know how you address this problem.
I can't tell you how many times in sort of an agency chief counsel role, you're told, oh, we can't do that because the lawyers say no. And then I say, which lawyer? When I first got to DA, I actually wanted to put a doll in my office and be like, oh, was it Merv over here? Because I'd ask around, who gave you that advice? Where does it come from? It's almost like this allure. I'm not saying that lawyers don't say that, but it's all about risk assessment usually. Sometimes there's a very hard line that you cannot cross. But short of that, it's usually a question of risk. Do you want to do this or don't you? Because here are the potential consequences that will happen when you do it. I can't cite to why that mentality is greater in the government than in the private. If it is, I don't know. Maybe you could speak to that. But maybe that's done elsewhere too, that they just say, oh, the lawyers told me that I couldn't do it.
Definitely exists elsewhere, because I know it exists in our organization. I always say it's all about risk and what the risk is. Not so much criminal risk, but usually it's business risk. If you're like a customer of our platform, all of our designs are actually these abstract art. And the reason it's abstract art is if it wasn't abstract, actually, there'd be a lot of compliance. We just make abstract art.
I love that.
It's like such a random consequence of regulations that all of our design and our hero images are abstract art.
That is another great adaptation when we're talking about what you can do to scale this, because you need to put it in a large organization, is finding those reoccurring barriers and removing them. You see a problem that is getting in the way of a lot of different things, and you can figure out a way to maximize. So you can't have 10 people on a case. You can only have two. You got to have the right two, but you have to have the flexibility to staff it in the way you need to staff it.
You've said this, and I actually have literally complained about this around business law, but justice is so slow in America. I got involved in the case that my father was involved with that literally been going on for 15 years, maybe 20 years. It was something like mid-80s to mid-2000s. I just thought it was insane. And you said it has to be slow, it has to be individualized. Does it have to be that slow? I don't understand.
I don't mean it has to be that slow. I mean, right now it is that slow because it is individualized. Now, it does need to be individualized because obviously they're individual cases. That's very important. A person has a right to face their accusers. There's all of these rights that are really important and critical rights. But justice can be achieved at a quicker pace. There's no question about that. The key is trying to find those barriers and I think remove them. Just because it's individualized doesn't mean that there aren't ways of multiplying the work that you're doing. There are certain forms that you can put into place to try and do a higher volume of cases quicker, even when you're individually assessing the facts of the case. One example, the DEA can take administrative actions against a pharmacy or a drug manufacturer or a doctor who is misprescribing or not using their licenses. DEA gives the ability to handle controlled substances to these entities. If they aren't using it the right way, we can bring an administrative action that forces them to either do it the right way, give up their license, whatever. It's like the SEC's administrative actions against corporations. And sometimes those go with criminal cases. Same thing in the drug context, but there was a low number because there are administrative law judges that ultimately review those. And there's a limited number of administrative law judges. There's a limited number of agents, but there are ways still that you can increase the volume because there are certain aspects that are repeated over and over. You know that you're going to have to prove A, B, and C. It doesn't mean that you are going to give the same A, B, and C for every case, but it means that you generally know the structure is A, B, and C. There's a lot of ways that we can help the process so that we could do more of these. And in fact, that has occurred. And there were like record numbers done in last years of these cases. So it is possible. It is important to recognize that while these systems are so, in some ways, hallowed and true and wonderful, justice is an ideal, and this is such an important fundamental part of our system, there are modifications that can be made. And we know this because in March 2020, I was criminal chief when the US shut down. Crime doesn't stop. It morphed into other ways. In that moment, I saw the judges, the defense counsel, the US Attorney's Office, everyone got together on calls and figured out, how are we going to do this? How are we going to work with the warden? How are we going to get someone into a jail? How are we going to make sure they have their confrontation clause rights preserved on a video call? How are we going to make sure they talk to their defense counsel? We went through every single step of the process that needed to happen and figured out a way to get it done, even in a circumstance where we couldn't put two people in the same room together. Obviously, we all know that this urgency creates innovation. It was what got so many of these court systems used to be paper filings. People had to drop it in drop boxes until COVID. These changes can occur that will speed up the process. The key, I think, is finding out how we can be open to making the changes.
Other than that example of the paper moving to digital, what other things changed for the better as a result of forced rapid adoption of a different way of doing the justice system?
Each district operates differently. The district I was in did most of the charging through the grand jury. If you can't bring in a grand jury, obviously it becomes difficult to do the charging. There is a way to charge criminal cases through complaints, which a lot of other districts do, where literally it's an affidavit of an agent that goes in that can then be examined by the court. Ultimately, a grand jury does need to weigh in on it, but it does move the process on a little bit faster. And it has the secondary aspect of informing the court and a little bit more information about the case rather than just the indictment that comes out of the grand jury. So there are tools like that that get a little bit forgotten and then they get uncovered when the need arises. Video court appearances, limited still, in the criminal context because defendants have the right to face their accusers. But during the time, there was some adoption of video, which allowed victims to participate from afar and I think has changed the dynamic of the ability to communicate with victims in a really significant way.
I can imagine if you're a victim, the last thing you want to do is be in the same room and must be so stressful. What about reforms? I know some of them are less feasible, but if you had more or even infinite power to reform the system, what would you do different?
It's hard for me to put my finger on exactly how the legislative reform would look, but I would want to figure out a way where there could be more discretion and accountability. Because I think when it is only held at certain levels in the system, it really clogs up the system. I think there are so many things that we could do internally. It takes great leaders, but the U.S. attorney at the time was very open when I was criminal chief that the AUSAs themselves signed the indictment. And I created a structure where my name's on the top of it, but they're signing it. They only came up the three levels to me when it was something that was being done differently, if they were proposing something outside the ordinary. If I'm looking at 20 instead of 300, it's a very different story. It's that pyramid. And so how do you get rid of it? I think another internal way of doing it is we all know that these big cases, there are endless motions being filed, almost to the point of shutting down the case because there are limited numbers of attorneys on the case. When there is the assistance of an appellate attorney, which is usually within the criminal division of U.S. Attorney's Office, it can be incredibly helpful to sort of cut through some of the motions. That case I was talking about earlier, I remember when I was prosecuting that case, going to a wedding on like the East Coast. Someone was in Michigan and writing defense motions in the case. They were like outsourced just at home writing motions.
If you had infinite power, you're a dictator for a day, you're whatever. Aren't there any bigger, more sweeping, simpler solutions? It just seems so depressing that like it requires only trench warfare.
Dictator for a day. I would want to shorten the timelines. I guess if I'm dictator for a day, I don't have to be thinking about the limited number of judicial resources, but that's a limiting factor. When you charge a case, there's only so many time slots in a week where a judge can bring that defendant in and move the case forward. If I were dictator for a day, I would put on time periods. The case has to move at a certain point. Motions have to be filed within X number of days after the indictment comes through, and then they have to be heard Y days after. There would be an exception, obviously, for complex cases. There are these local rules sometimes that exist, but the rules have been eaten by the realities of how practice normally happens, and it just takes a long time to get to trial.
For me, who's a person far from this, when I look at country and see if we had 10x more judges and 10x more resources, it's still not that big a percentage of the U.S. GDP, I don't think, that we're spending on justice. If we 10x'd it, would the country be better off, or do you think it probably wouldn't change ultimately that much?
You'd have to have it in combination with some of the stuff I was talking about. I don't think throwing resources at it without any confines will really solve the problem. I think it would have to be a combination of we're going to put more resources and we're going to make sure and we're going to say because we put these resources, everyone is going to get into court by a certain day. They have to have the trial date. And by the way, there is the right to a speedy trial. It just oftentimes gets waived. That does exist. It's just not something that you normally see happen.
People waive their right to a speedy trial?
Oftentimes.
What does that mean?
If they're filing motions, it will pause the speedy trial clock. They'll ask for a trial date that's beyond the speedy trial. And they'll say the court will make a ruling that it's a complex case and it can't be done. By the way, I'm talking the federal system. I can't speak to the state system. The state system, my guess is that it moves much quicker than the federal system, although I don't know.
Yeah, I only know business courts, and they're not fast.
I do think the criminal justice system does tend to move much faster than the civil system.
It's wild to me. If time matters for you, you've lost. If you're in a business situation, and one party basically can move on. You can't move on, you're done. You made reference to some large corporate cases. I know one where there was a very large company. I don't know if I'm allowed to say which one. There was like explosion, and it sounded like there was just a huge case. And then the company subsequently went bankrupt, which felt like it was culturally consistent. And I don't know how much you can speak to it. It seemed like a very interesting example of trying to keep large companies accountable and how hard it is. Under the law, corporations are people to some extent, but yet they're not really accountable like people are.
It is extremely rare for a corporation to face criminal charges. A lot of times you'll either hear about a corporation facing civil sanctions or you'll hear about individuals in a corporation facing criminal charges. That actually had been decreasing. The Justice Department a few years ago, I think, started increasing NDAs and DPAs, deferred prosecution agreements, non-prosecution agreements, where these aren't these agreements that if you modify and change your behavior and they see an improvement, then they won't charge you. The Justice Department was sort of leaning into these different aspects. I think what isn't understood potentially is the amount of consequences to a corporation that faces criminal charges, because it is so rare. A lot of times people might say, oh, well, what happens? The corporation can't go to jail. But in a way, they do go to jail, because if there is a criminal conviction against a corporation, they actually have a period of probation following their sentence with the court. If you can think of what happens during a probationary period, there's a probation officer. And if it's a federal case, that means that probation officer has access to law enforcement agents and they get a report that the corporation is doing something untoward. Doesn't even have to be in the same exact area, but they're supposed to behave in a certain way. For 5 years or whatever the period of probation is, the corporation is under sort of a microscope, which is a form of prison, I would say, for the corporation. It's an extreme consequence. It can also be followed by a period of supervised release where the judge is making sure that the corporation essentially does no wrong. And if they do, then the judge makes a decision, brings in executives, is giving feedback to the corporation about how they are doing as a corporation, which I could imagine would be very hard to run a corporation in that rubric. There are other consequences. The case I think that you are mentioning, they had to put an ad in the paper and the Wall Street Journal saying that the corporation was a convicted felon to notify victims that as part of a consequence of their actions, 8 people died and 38 homes were destroyed. There are a lot of different consequences that can come from a corporate conviction that I think sometimes it's not understood. It's pretty significant, which is why it is rare for corporations to get charged, but it is extremely rare for them to go to trial.
But it seems like in that instance, that company ended up continuing to follow a culture of bad behavior and then ultimately went bankrupt because more bad things happened. Maybe recidivism is common among corporations as it is among people, but it didn't seem like the conviction changed the trajectory of the company.
Maybe the hope would be that it brought to light what was going on in the corporation. And because of the conviction, the consequences that you're identifying were a light was shed on them, as opposed to if there hadn't been the case brought.
If I were thinking about, okay, you can go to prison or they can be an ad about you in the Wall Street Journal, I'd be like, oh, I'll just take this ad.
The judge can issue orders when you're in probation or supervised relief that bind the company. Generally, when corporations are in that position, they might also have to have a federal monitor that is monitoring their activity. In order to be able to prove a corporate entity's, the crime has to be so pervasive through the corporation. That's when it's going to get to that point past individuals. It's going to be more likely in those circumstances that it's so ingrained in the corporation that maybe it can pivot and maybe it can come out of it. But that's why they have to go through a period of probation.
If you look at the next 5 years, so it's 5 years from now, it's middle of 2030, AI has probably completely transformed a lot of sectors. What do you see as trends? No one saw fentanyl coming, I don't think. And it had this huge effect. What are like the things that worry you and make you hopeful for the rest of this decade?
Crime used to be confined to certain localities. There was a street corner. There was a racetrack. There was a convenience store. There were all these different localities. Now it's within the confines of one's home. in a place that people feel very safe. They're sitting on their couch. There's access to designer drugs. There's access to potential grooming that we would think wouldn't happen. And I think that is going to be pivotal for us to figure out how, when locality is no longer the issue, and you really think about, okay, all the access to crime, identity fraud, financial fraud, violent crime even, is brought into your home. And we're a place where we have all thought of ourselves as very safe. What does that mean? Before I cause you to be too depressed, I think you have seen more and more efforts of private and public partnerships. I think the tech companies are coming in and talking more to the government. You've seen increased focus on public safety. I think people are recognizing this issue, but I think that's an area that everyone understands we have to lean into.
I'm an AI optimist, which is actually unusual. Most people are AI pessimists outside of Silicon Valley. So I think AI is going to help with that, but obviously it could make it worse. My last question is about human insights and human behavior. You've seen people probably at their worst. Maybe you've seen people at their best when you were in tech. Maybe also when we watch these agents really try to get after big problems. Do you have any harder insights on human nature?
It's that last thing you mentioned. I'm still an optimist. 22 years in DOJ, and I've seen a lot of bad actors. I would still say that the fact that we have so many investigators and lawyers and other public servants willing to put their lives on the line, it's remarkable. Even with everything else we've talked about, I've just seen over and over so many incredible cases. I had a case where this agent was undercover for 6 years. It was the longest undercover in the history. Now it's probably been surpassed, but it was a crazy case.
What kind of undercover is that?
There was illegal importation of counterfeit cigarettes coming in the country, and drugs and weapons. They were coming through ports, and the undercover was, they had an inside with someone at customs and facilitated this activity. And it was an incredible case. This whole team dedicated so much of their lives to making sure, and it was this international case. It was just remarkable. I'm citing these big cases. I also think when I was criminal chief in California, there was a San Francisco police officer who worked with this ATF agent to put together this operation. They were smaller cases, but they ended up taking out like 148 defendants, which was this massive amount of guns and drugs in the Bay Area. There's just these individual drivers that I think make me very optimistic, even though I have seen some of the most deplorable behavior.
I bet. I've had this debate with somebody, which is that in any city, I know in Washington, D.C., a very small number of people are responsible for the vast majority of crime. D.C. is about 600,000 people. It's probably a few hundred. And yet, it's not how we police the system.
So there's a lot of opportunity.
Why is that? I know there's civil rights issues and things like that, but it just seems strange. If you can just figure out how to prosecute the few hundred people who are responsible for the vast majority of crime, you could have a very effective, cost-effective, and socially effective impact. Mostly doesn't seem to be what happens. And I'm not sure why.
There can be a lot done with strategic investigations. I think that's what you're talking about. In a way that protects civil liberties, you throw out civil rights. I'm assuming it's focusing singularly on a particular individual, which if that particular individual is engaged in crime, it's totally appropriate to be investigating the crime that they're committing. There is a distinction there that I think is an important one.
I'm like totally guilty of the social media informed view of the world. I see these posts about people who've been arrested 55 times, coming in and out of the system, in and out of the system, and then they do a horrible thing eventually. And I wonder, well, what's going on here? Why is this happening? Is this concentrated source of the problem, which is mostly my experience, is Pareto principle. It's always 80-20. It's always this small group of people. These are the founders you talk about in your organization. They can have good effects or bad effects, but it's always these tail effects. Yet it's just sort of not the narrative.
I think you're touching on the needed flexibility to change an organization. When I came to DEA, the way the organizational structure even was of the chief counsel's office was crazy to me, because it's like 140 attorneys, but not necessarily structurally the way that met what we were doing as a mission now. when I asked, where did this come from? Why are these two things separated when one would inform the other? And it should be the same attorneys working on it because they all the way through the system would know how to regulate, and was told, well, it's always been that way. These are the things that I think drive people crazy. It's been that way for 30 years. When I reorganized it, I got a lot of, oh, are you allowed to do that? Of course, you can do a reorganization territorially. It makes people very uncomfortable. But having the difficult conversations with the people is something that, unfortunately, I think maybe in all organizations, but it does seem that people shy away from, which is necessary to change it to a position where you can do strategic cases. And I think clear the path for people to be able to focus on that.
I feel lucky as an American that we have people like you who can be as successful as you were in business and then go back to public service and do this founders or entrepreneurial activity, reforming the system. So thank you again for coming on Onward. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being here.
All right, Onward. You've been listening to Onward featuring Hallie Hoffman, former general counsel of the DEA, and former chief of the criminal division at the U.S. Attorney's Office. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. If you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. Thanks so much for joining me.